All right, so let's turn to Book of Leviticus, chapter 6. And it begins this way in the English. And Yahuwah spoke unto Moshe, saying, and a lot of times it'll say, tell or speak to Aharon and this and his sons, but that's not how this portion begins. What it says is, Zav, command Aaron and his sons, saying, this is the Torah of the burnt offering. It's that which goes up, by definition, on its firewood, on the altar, all night until the morning. And the fire of the altar shall be kept burning thereby. So, right away, we see this word Zav. Of course, that's where the Torah portion takes its name from. And the question is, this has seemed to be a little bit more imperative than some of the other things that we're used to seeing. You know, tell Aaron, speak to Aaron. No, this one is command him. And he is being commanded concerning the Torah, the instruction about Ha'olah, this thing that goes up. And yeah, the burnt offering, but the key is that it ascends, it goes up. What I want to do tonight is a little bit different than I do sometimes. The portion is not extremely long, and of course, to some extent, there are some things in here that at least would look a little bit like repetition. We talked about the offering last week a bit, the various types, and what we're going to see here is some more specifics of the things that are going to go on. I will go through those briefly, like, for example, verse 3, priest shall put on his linen garment, his breeches, takes up the ashes of the fire that's consumed the burnt offering on the altar. He puts them besides the altar, takes off his garments, puts on other garments, changes clothes, in other words, and then carries those ashes outside of the camp somewhere to a clean place. The fire on the altar shall be kept burning thereby. It is not to go out. Priest put wood on it every morning, he lays the burnt offering upon it, and he makes smoke thereon, the fat of the various peace offerings. Shalomim. The fire shall be kept burning upon the altar continually. It is not to go out. And then we hear about the offering that is called the meal offering, the mincha. Sons of Aaron are to offer it before Yahuwah in front of the altar. Fine flour, oil, all the frankincense on it, and they make a memorial part, a little bit of it, smoke upon the altar for a sweet savor before Yod Heh Vav Heh, and that which is left, it's to be eaten. It's for Aaron and his sons. Without leaven, it's to be eaten in a set-apart place in the court of the tent of meeting. They eat it. It's not to be baked with leaven. I've given it as their portion, he says. This is for the sons of Aaron among the Levites. Made by fire. It's most set apart, as is the sin offering and as is the guilt offering. And all of the males among Aaron's children may eat of it. It's a due forever, again, throughout your generations, from the offerings of Yahuwah made by fire. Anyone that touches it, though, needs to be set apart. And then it's going to talk about some other things here, but at this point I want to pause and just do a little bit more exposition, I guess you would say. And here's another one of those portions where, to some extent, as we go through a couple of things, I'm probably going to end up asking more questions than I'm going to try to do in terms of giving answers. Now, if you haven't figured it out by now, I kind of like questions. I think questions, to some extent, are the essence of Midrash. We ask ourselves questions. The good teacher likes to hear his students ask questions. Questions are a great thing. It's a way of making sure we know. And the same thing is true when people try to teach things. Ask the questions, expect the questions. They're a good thing all the way around. What I am trying to say is there are going to be a number of teachings and things that people are going to say, well, these offerings are symbolic of this or that, or they mean this or that, or the offerings are this or that. And I'm not sure that that is ever quite as clear, just as we were talking a little while ago about there being some differences of opinion about when various days should be celebrated and how it's to be done. Hey, is it the new moon sighted in Jerusalem, or is it where you're at? How about sundown? Is that local sundown? Is that, you know, sidereal, marine, maritime, celestial? Or is it a sundown at a particular place in the world? Or do we just kind of keep one? You know, the point is there's all kinds of ways of understanding and interpreting these things. And probably, at least in terms of coming to a way that we should understand it for ourselves, it's at least important to start asking those questions. So we're going to do some of that. Like I started to say, I guess when it comes to this idea of telling people, well, this is what something means, I don't, as a general rule, like to go there. Now, it's a little bit more straightforward if Torah just comes out and tells you, this is what something means. Or, don't do this or do this. Well, those are more clear, generally. I guess more than anything, the thing that I don't like to hear is, well, this couldn't mean that. Or this can't be something, as if the person that is making that proclamation, has a greater understanding than maybe the entity that wrote it. I'm not sure. But we don't get into that problem when we get with questions. So as we go through this tonight, I'm going to also, I'm going to ask the questions, what is the deal with these so-called sacrifices, with this korban? What we're seeing here tonight are mostly processes that are involved in it. We're going to also talk about the end of the portion where there is a procedure for induction or inauguration of the people that are going to go through the processes. All of that is important. But as at least one teacher puts it, what's the deal with these sacrifices? Why? Why did Elohim choose these, if there are means to an end, these particular ways of getting there? And I'm looking at least one of the Midrashim that I've got, actually got several of them sitting here that essentially say something similar. These are some of the deepest questions that are being asked. They would say in Judaism, I would say in a study of the Torah. And of course, as you might expect, there have been many, many answers given to a whole lot of those things. And I'll at least touch on some of those. Again, my point is more about asking questions than it is trying to give an answer. Sometimes, one of the ways we can get a little bit of a hint on that is to also go to the things that the prophets have said later. And I guess this is a good time to do that. I was thinking about going through a little bit more of the Parsha first, but no, I changed my mind. Let's turn to at least one of the traditional readings that goes along with this one. It's a pretty good one. Comes from the book of, or the prophecies of Yirmeyahu, Jeremiah, chapter 7. And in this case, at least the title heading in the New King James Study Bible I got sitting here caught my eye, because it does sound like something that happens a lot. It was also kind of on my mind as I was putting the news together for tonight. Trusting in lying words, it says. Trusting in lying words. Well, that probably describes modern America about as much as anything. I won't go through the whole chapter, but I will at least summarize some of this, because this not only helps us understand a little bit about the Torah portion, but I think it fits very, very well with where we are in history today, too. The words came to the prophet Jeremiah from Yahuwah, saying, "Stand, O prophet, stand in the gate of the house of Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. Proclaim there this word and say, hear the word of the Lord." Actually, hear the word of Yahuwah. "All you of Judah who enter in at these gates to worship Yahuwah. Thus says Yahuwah Zevuot, Elohim of Israel, amend your ways and your doings, and I'll let you dwell in this place. Do not trust in these lying words," saying things like the temple of the Lord, or the temple of Yahuwah, the temple of Yahuwah, the temple of Yahuwah are these. "For he says, if you will thoroughly amend your ways and your doings, and if you will begin to thoroughly execute judgment between a man and his neighbor, if you do not do all these things that seem to be repeated over and over again, don't oppress the stranger, the fatherless, the widow, don't shed innocent blood in this place, do not walk after other gods to your own hurt. Well, then, he says, I'll let you dwell. I will cause you, in fact, to dwell in this place, in the land that I gave your fathers forever and ever." Well, of course, we have the benefit of hindsight. We know that that didn't happen. And in fact, northern, southern kingdoms, you name it, have all been kicked out of the land over time, scattered. There's a beginning, it looks like, of people returning to the land, but perhaps not necessarily in the way that we know that it will happen one of these days. "Behold," verse 8 says, "you trust in lying words that cannot profit." Let me run that one by again. You trust in lying words that cannot profit. Nowadays, we can get them on, 175 different channels via satellite and cable. You can get lying words of your flavor. Will you steal, murder, commit adultery, swear falsely, burn incense to Baal, walk after other gods whom you don't know, and then come and stand before me in this house, which is called by my name, or at least it used to be now, they just say the house of the Lord, and forget not only the name or the tetragrammaton, but more importantly, the fact that it's about his character. If we don't study his word, how can we possibly know his character? Has this house, which is called by my name, he asks, become a den of thieves in your eyes? That probably sounds familiar. Behold, I have seen it, says Yahuwah. All right, now he says there's going to be a whole bunch of things that happen. And he reminds them that not only is there a possibility that if they keep doing what they're doing, they're going to get kicked out, but look at what happened to your brothers up north there, the whole posterity of Ephraim. They blew it big time. So therefore, he says, don't even pray for this people, nor lift up a cry or prayer for them, nor make intercession to me. I ain't going to listen, for I will not hear you. You've been looking. Do you see what they do in the streets of Judah, in the streets of Jerusalem, in the cities all over the kingdom? Children gather wood, fathers kindle fire. The women knead dough. I think this is an interesting line. Maybe this will ring a bell. The women make cakes for the Queen of Heaven. The Queen of Heaven. If that sounds familiar, it ought to, because that's essentially Mary worship. It's been institutionalized by the Universal and Roman Catholic Church. They pour out drink offerings to other gods that they may provoke me to anger. Aren't they doing this to their own shame, he asks. So, yep, I'm going to have some fury. It's going to be poured out on this place. On man and beast, trees of the field, fruit of the ground, it'll burn and not be quenched. Now, here is where we get to the place that connects with the Torah portion tonight. All of that is some really interesting and important preface. After talking about the anger, and after talking about the paganism, and after talking about a whole bunch of things that if we'll look at them honestly, wow, Solomon had it right. Ain't nothing new under the sun. He gets around to saying this. Thus says Yahuwah Zevuot, Elohim of Israel. Lord of hosts is how it's rendered in the English a lot of times. God of Israel, add your burnt offerings to your sacrifices and eat meat. Now listen to this and ask yourself the question, what? Did I hear that right? Did I read that right? This is Jeremiah 7, verse 22. For I did not speak to your fathers or command them in the day that I brought them out of the land of Egypt concerning burnt offerings or sacrifices. But this is what I commanded them, saying, obey my voice, and I'll be your Elohim, and you shall be my people, and walk in all the ways that I've commanded you, that it may be well with you. But hey, he said, you didn't do that. You didn't obey or incline their ear, but followed counsels and dictates of their evil hearts. You went backward and not forward. And basically, hey, same old story. Now, again, we can see that. We can certainly look at the world today and say, all right, all of this resonates. It rings true. Except for this verse 22 there. Did we hear that right? Did it get translated right from the Hebrew? For I did not speak to your fathers or command them in that day that I brought them out of the land of Mitzrayim concerning burnt offerings or sacrifices. Well, okay, we could be Clintonian here. This was a slightly different day. Is that what he's talking about? No, that's a little bit too twisting of words. Sounds too much like lawyerese. I'm looking at a piece by Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks that addresses this same glaring contradiction, as he puts it. Well, clearly, we can read what it says. Matter of fact, the portion is called Zav Command, Aaron and his sons. About what? About these sacrifices. Whoa, come on. So what is going on here? All right. Well, says the rabbi, looking at other rabbinic sources, there's a whole bunch of solutions, as you might expect, that have been offered over the years. For example, Maimonides, the Rambam, says these sacrifices were a means, not an end, to the service of Elohim. There's a fellow named Radak who argues that these sacrifices, well, they weren't the first of the commands that Elohim gave after the Exodus. Well, instead we had civil laws first. You can argue about what's first. Does that mean that we can understand the wording a little bit differently? And then there are those who go on to say, well, initially Elohim hadn't gonna plan on giving the Israelites a code of sacrifices, but he changed his mind after this mess with the golden calf. So all kinds of explanations. You know, quite frankly, as I read through the list, none of those really resonated with me. I did like the one that he lists here and says, look, here's the simplest explanation. It's got to do with the Hebrew language. Let's talk about it for a second. The word lo, right? Lo this, lo that. Don't do this. It does not always and invariably and only mean not or no. Because sometimes it can, in context, mean something a little bit more subtle, like not only or not just. In other words, no, but there's more to it. So if you look at it that way, say some of the sages, and this tends, again, I think, to be the most reasonable sounding explanation, Yirmiyahu's not saying that Elohim didn't command sacrifices. He did. He clearly did. He's just saying that they weren't the sole or even the most important element of what he did command, of a life, if you will. So the common denominator in this critique by Yirmiyahu, the prophet, of sacrifice, it is not direct opposition, saying that they're wrong, but, and I like this phraseology, rather it's an insistence that acts directed to God, to Elohim, must never dull our sense of other duties, in particular, our duty to mankind. Justice, that's mentioned a couple times in here. Justice, justice, you will serve. That, of course, is very consistent with Torah, something we see elsewhere. Don't be thinking that you can just go out and whack on a sacrifice and that obviates the need to do the other things. Micah, he quotes, gives a very famous and excellent expression in the English, as it's translated, to this particular thought. Micah 6:6. With what shall I come before Yahuwah and bow down before the exalted Elohim, he says. Will the Lord be pleased with thousands of rams, with tens of thousands of rivers of oil? He has shown you, O man, what is good. What does Yahuwah require of you? To act justly and to love mercy and to walk humbly before your God. You've heard that. Again, I think that's key, and that kind of helps to put things together, and I guess it actually tends to kind of phrase the concept of Jeremiah 7, trust in lying words. When we look at the Torah and the prophets, and we appear to see a contradiction, it pays to look a little bit deeper. And particularly, that's true, I will suggest, when we see consequences being visited on bad behavior. Those I love, I will chasten, he says. And when you see prophetic things coming true and him saying, look, I told you not to do this, you did it anyway, now you're going to have to suffer the consequences of your bad behavior, it pays to say, okay, when he tells you, I didn't tell you this, I told you something different, gee, Abba, let's make sure we understand this. It's not just about the sacrifices. And one of the things, too, of course, that in a context of differentiation with some things that we will also hear from the so-called church, a friend of mine puts it this way. This is a little bit tacky, but I like it. He says, Jesus Christ did not die on the cross so you could eat a ham sandwich. In other words, it's not about getting the get-out-of-hell-free card, too, saying the prayer once and done. There's all kinds of things that you can look at and say, okay, hey, it's not just. It's not only. There's more to it. And it's not that the sacrifices are the end-all and the be-all. Even what people will say, the one sacrifice. Because if, well, as John 14:15 says, if you love me, keep my commandments. Why do you call me Lord, Lord, says another verse, and not do the things I say? All of this stuff you would think would be fairly clear, and yet we've been lied to for so long. We've trusted in lying words for so long that we missed the point. And the point, of course, is right here in Yirmiyahu again, next verse, 23. This is what I commanded them, he says, saying, obey my voice. I'll be your Elohim. You shall be my people. You can walk in all the ways that I have commanded you, that it may be well with you. That seems pretty clear. The rest of the chapter, by the way, is about the fact that they didn't do that. And if you don't do this, if you continue to set up abominations in the house which is called by my name, and you do all of this jazz, well, look forward to corpses being food for birds and so forth. Lots of bad stuff will happen. That's where the next chapter goes to. All right, let's go back just briefly, talk a little bit more about a couple of these sacrifices. I'm gonna essentially encourage folks to read it because the details are important. He gives us, there's no idle word in Torah, all of this for a reason. But there's a lot of other places that I want to make sure we touch on tonight, again, with this idea of the bigger picture and understanding some of the questions. What is it about the sacrifices? Since we cannot do some of these things today, right, this fire that's to be kept burning isn't burning today because the altar's not there, neither is there a tabernacle nor a mishkan or anything else. So here's the Torah of the meal offering to be offered. We've already gone through some of that, telling about who can eat it. Yahuwah continues speaking to Moshe in verse 12. This is the offering of Aaron and his sons. 10th part of an ephah of fine flour for a meal offering perpetually. Half in the morning, half in the evening. And it talks about how it's to be cooked up on a griddle here, made with oil. And actually, you know, you read this, it does kind of want to make you hungry. And the anointed priest, that shall be in his stead. From among his sons shall offer it. It's a dew forever, made holy into smoke unto Yahuwah. Not to be eaten in this case. He continues, end of chapter 6. Speak to Aaron and his sons. How? Now we're going to talk about the chatat, the sin offering. The place where the burnt offering is killed, that's where it's going to be also killed. It is most set apart. The priest that offers it for sin is to eat it in a set apart place in the court of the tent of meeting. Anybody that eats that flesh, touches it, is to also be set apart. Then it talks about what happens if various kinds of things get sodden with it. If an earthen vessel is sodden, it's to be broken. A brazen vessel, it's to be scoured, rinsed in water. No sin offering where any of the blood is brought into the tent of meeting to make atonement shall be eaten. It is to be burned with fire. Then it goes on into chapter 7, the guilt offering, ha'asham. It is also most set apart. Same place where they kill the burnt offering, and they kill the guilt offering. And it describes, again, all the parts that are going to be offered. The fat, tail, the fat that covers the innards, the kidneys, fat on them, the loins, the lobe above the liver. Priests shall make them smoke upon the altar. As is the sin offering, so is the guilt offering. One Torah for them. Priest that makes the atonement, he shall have it. And then we get to the sacrifice of the shlamim, the peace offerings, before Yod-Heh, Vav-Heh. If there is to be thanksgiving, Todah, Korban Todah. He's to offer it with the sacrifice of thanksgiving, unleavened cakes mingled with oil, unleavened wafer spread with oil, cakes mingled with oil, fine flour soaked. Now, this one is a little bit unique because verse 13 says, oh, in this case alone, leavened bread he shall present his offering with the sacrifice of peace offerings for thanksgiving. This is kind of a bounty with a lot of different elements. He shall present one out of each of offerings unto Yahuwah, and the priest that dashes the blood of the peace offerings against the altar gets those. The flesh of the sacrifice of his peace offerings for thanksgiving shall be eaten on the same day. You're not to leave it until morning. But if the sacrifice is for a vow or a freewill offering, it's to be eaten on the day that he offers it, and on the morrow, what remains can be eaten, but none of it's to be kept past the third day. Therefore, after that, or on the third day, it's to be burned with fire. What happens if people don't do these things right? The soul that eats of the flesh of the sacrifice of the peace offerings that are for Yod-Heh Vav-Heh, he has uncleanness upon him. That is to be a one who is cut off from among his people. Same thing goes for one that touches an unclean thing of man or of beast or detestable things, and then eats these peace offerings that pertains to Yahuwah. He too, that soul, nefesh, shall be cut off from his people. And then Yod-Heh Vav-Heh at the end of this chapter says, speak to the children of Israel and say to them, you're not to eat any fat of ox or sheep or goat. And the part of that which dies of itself, torn of beast, That can be used for other stuff, but you're not to eat of it. Whoever eats the fat of the beast, which men present an offering made by fire unto Yahuwah, that soul too gets cut off. And for crying out loud, don't eat blood, whether it's a fowl or a beast in any of your dwellings. That too is a soul that will be cut off. More description of how it's to be done, and then the conclusion at chapter 7's end says, this is the Torah of the burnt offering, the olah, of the meal offering, the mincha, of the sin offering, chatat, and of the guilt offering, asham, and the peace offerings, shalamim, which Moshe was commanded by Yahuwah in Mount Sinai on the day that he commanded the children of Israel to present all of their offerings unto Yahuwah. Now, I mentioned that we were heading up to one other place, and this is kind of interesting. Chapter 8 is at the conclusion of this portion, describing to us the inauguration ceremony, if you will, the induction ceremony. And clearly, it's a very detailed procedure, lots and lots of information here. And as, I saw an interesting video. A lot of times we'll watch David Foreman's stuff, and this week, I gotta admit, I forgot to write it down. It was another junior rabbi in his fellowship there. His name was also David, but I confess I've forgotten his last name. But he did the presentation and essentially said, hey, this is one of those things that Rabbi Foreman likes to ask the question. Where have we seen something like this before? They play the I think it's not quite Jeopardy music, some of the game show music. And where else in Torah have we seen very, very similar sounding phrases? And here you got this very detailed procedure. Let's just give you a real quick couple of high points from it. And ask the question as we go through this, where else do we see a similar process described or a similar set of words in Scripture? And it begins with how are we going to do this inauguration, this induction process? Verse 6, Moshe brings Aaron and his sons and he washes them with water, cleans them up. Then he dresses them up with all the good stuff, the tunic, the girdle, the robe, and the breastplate, the Urim and the Tumim. So there's lots of detail about how they get dressed up here. But we start with this idea of let's wash them in the water. Okay? And then the next thing that happens is they get some fresh clothing. Okay? And then when they go through all the rest of this process, we're going to see it says that they're going to sit for 7 days in the tent of meeting. 7 days. Oh, and there's one other element of this, too. After they sacrifice the ram, make the ram smoke upon the altar, a burnt offering for a sweet savor offered by fire unto Yahuwah, as Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh commanded Moshe, the other ram was presented. Aaron and his sons laid their hands upon the ram. And after that one was slaughtered, there's a note, at least in the Hebrew text, that says there may have been a pause here, too, hesitation. We could spend probably an hour talking about the things that are written about the specific marks in the Torah that ask the question, hey, if Moshe paused at this point, why? But I guess it's off track. I just think it's interesting to note some things that don't end up showing up in the English at all. If you look at the words without some of the Hebrew cantillation-type marks, you don't get it at all. Because it sounds like it's the same thing that it says before, after it was slain, verse 15 and so forth. Anyway, at this point, Moshe takes the blood of this ram of consecration, and he puts it in three specific places. Aaron's right ear, at the tip, upon the thumb of his right hand, and on his big toe of his right foot. Now, wait a minute. That, too, sounds familiar. Lobe of the ear, tip of the ear, right hand, thumb, big toe. On the right side. Okay, well, we'll save the suspense and just say if you turn to Leviticus chapter 14, and I've got my bookmark in there, and look and see what procedures being described. Yeah, there are certain similarities. They're not identical, and certainly the sacrifices or the things that are done, and in some cases even a lot of the words are different. There are certainly animals that are offered, and some of the words are the same, some are different. But this is chapter 14. And it's the portion that's called Metzorah. This shall be the law of HaMetzorah, the leper. And, yeah, we've talked about it before. We'll get to that in just a couple weeks. It's not necessarily the best possible translation, but it's the common one anyway. What do we see with the instruction concerning the Metzorah? Well, turns out, looks a lot like this. There's water involved. The person who is to be cleaned up, let's go through it, not in detail, just briefly. This shall be the Torah of HaMetzorah, and the day of his cleansing. Well, you know how cleansing is going to start, right? He washes. He does some stuff with some birds first. But then he washes the man, or the woman, the person who is to be cleansed from being a Metzorah. Washes clothes. Shaves off all his hair, too. Bathes in water. Then he may be clean. I'm guessing somewhere in there he's going to get dressed, put on clean clothes, and he too dwells outside his tent 7 days. Certain differences, but we got certain similarities too. The reference to the tent, dwelling for 7 days after getting all cleaned up and putting on new clothes. Then there's more process, and then guess what? This time it's not blood. This time the priest takes some oil, pours it in the palm of his left hand, and he dips his right finger in the oil, and he sprinkles the oil first 7 times before Yahuwah, and then the rest of the oil. Guess what he does with it? He puts it upon the tip of the right ear of him that's to be cleansed, and then upon the thumb of his right hand. You want to guess where the last place is? Yeah, you already know. It's on the big toe of his right foot, upon the blood of the guilt offering. Well, no question, this does sound fairly similar. So what do we make of all of this? What, for crying out loud, does Aaron and his sons and those who follow after them have to do with leprosy and the cleansing of people who are involved in leprosy? We're cleaning up Aaron and inaugurating him to the Levitical priesthood to be a Kohen Gadol, high priest even. How can we possibly compare that to a Metzorah, a leper? Well, maybe the thing to do is just step back again and ask some questions. What is it that is generally said, at least in terms of the kind of the standard teaching about Metzorah, about the leper? Most people are probably thinking, well, Lashon Hara, the evil tongue. Speaking bad things, gossip, if you will, about other people. In general, I like the summary that was offered on David Foreman's site. You know what we're kind of talking about here is interpersonal sin, kinds of things that break fellowship, that destroy relationship, that literally would take somebody and move them to a place where they deserve to be, as we see with the leper, outside the camp. As a matter of fact, it's a decision that is kind of, if you think about it, self-imposed. They have chosen to be out of fellowship by doing certain things that should not be done. It's a betrayal of relationship. Well, right there, okay, we can step back and say, do we see other places in Scripture where we have a betrayal of relationship? Certainly. That's the whole point of the book, right? There's a betrayal of relationship right in the garden. And, oh, what just happened in the lives of Aaron and his sons and indeed all the people that came out of Mitzrayim? They saw the miracles. They saw the ketubah, the contract, the covenant that was issued at Mount Sinai, and they saw the cavorting before the golden calf. They saw the whoring, the adultery. They saw the breach of fellowship. At least part of the duties of the priest certainly have to do with restoring that breach of relationship. Now, here is a term that I thought was interesting because it was used by people that come from a, let's just say, not-so-Christian tradition, right? This is more of a straight-line Judaism, and they actually used the word several times, rebirth, in terms of rebirth of relationship. You could almost quote something you've probably heard elsewhere, you know, about being born again. What is it, they concluded, that this ritual signifies? It's about a rebirth of relationship. It's about Aaron and his sons being ministers for me, priests for me, entering into this set-apart place. I guess there's probably, if you wanted to ask some more questions, maybe some womb-like connections. There are certainly garden-like connections that have been associated with this. There's a place that is set apart for him A small place within a bigger world made by men. On the other hand, you have the corresponding bookend. The Garden of Eden was a place within a bigger world made by Elohim for man. Lots and lots of interesting parallels. And then certainly you have the whole metaphor of birth itself. New life coming out of a place that is set apart within a womb. Is it much of a leap to think, you know, there really does seem to be something going on here? What is the essence of so many of these so-called sacrifices of Korban? Well, it's the end of the life of some animal. There's a real poignant resonance there. It speaks to us in some way or other. I've got a lot more Midrash. The same Rabbi Sachs talks about this question of why sacrifices, right? I've already alluded to this. Why this particular means to an end? You can go back to all kinds of places in Scripture and see who offered sacrifices. You got the question of what was wrong with Cain's sacrifice? Abel's was preferred. Cain decided, or did he? Some have suggested. Maybe he needs to sacrifice Abel. You don't like my first sacrifice, my veggies? Well, here you go. Take my brother. We don't know exactly what was going through his head. It certainly seems to be have been suggested he didn't necessarily understand that Abel wasn't coming back, because nobody had been killed before that point. There are a whole bunch of sages that have pointed out, okay, let's look at this issue of sacrifice and say, maybe it's better that they kill animals rather than men. There are absolute prohibitions in Scripture against killing men. So, you know, what else can we glean from this? People have written all kinds of stuff. Like I said, if you don't somehow channel this perhaps arguably innate human tendency towards violence and killing into something that is specified, proscribed, and prescribed, don't kill people. You can kill animals. Maybe there's a cycle of vengeance that happens. Is this part of the Torah's program to construct a world redeemed from the otherwise interminable cycle of revenge, they ask. Oh, and by the way, over and over again, we saw it in Jeremiah, we've seen it in other places, there's this idea of justice. What's the goal? What does Jeremiah say? Seek justice. It wasn't all about sacrifices, or at least it wasn't only. I didn't only command them, not only about sacrifices. Obey my voice. I'll be your Elohim. You'll be my people if you walk in the ways that I have commanded you, that it may be well with you. Understand that it's about justice. He quotes Amos at the end of this section. Prophet Amos, chapter 5, verse 23-24, says, "Even though you bring me," this is the words in red, Yod Heh-Vav-Heh speaking, "even though you bring me burnt offerings and grain offerings, I won't accept them. But let justice roll down like a river, and righteousness like a never-failing stream." I guess all of that makes good sense, too. So what do we make of all of this? Well, we've got certainly a whole lot going on here. Like I said, I'm not going to try to tell you this is or isn't something. I'm just going to say, isn't it interesting to read through what the Torah does say and ask ourselves some questions? Why the sacrifices? What's the message here? What's the message about these different types of korban and the process that's being offered? What's the message of the fact that the Kohen Gadol, the high priest, is going to be set apart, and that there's going to be this induction or inauguration ritual described in great detail? And yes, it's not an identical match. No, I'm not trying to say that it is. But there are certainly some undeniable similarities with the process for redeeming one who has been put into self-imposed exile by his own acts of interpersonal sin, breaking fellowship, betraying relationship. And when the time comes to clean him up, that looks pretty similar in more than a few ways. Maybe the differences, too, tell us some remarkable things. And ultimately, it is about restoring relationship, and ultimately, it's also about, one way or the other, some kind of rebirth. You know, there's a famous line where Yeshua talks to Oh, and I'm drawing a blank. Name starts with an N. anyway, one of the rabbis of his time. And he says, hey, wait a minute. You know, you don't understand the question about getting back in the womb and being reborn. You don't, haven't you been taught? You don't know these things? In other words, this concept of rebirth is nothing new. And again, we can see that it shows up all throughout the Torah. It might even show up in places that we don't at first recognize it. Can we restore fellowship? Is the sacrifice enough? Well, certainly the sacrifice isn't enough. Nicodemus, thank you, Snake Stomper. I it was a senior moment. I knew it started with an N, and if I hadn't paused, it'd have come right out of my mouth before I knew what I was doing. But I paused, and that can be a bad thing. So anyway, any other questions or comments or feedback of something I might have forgotten? Because I'm going to end it there. We'll talk a little bit about some of the things that are in the news. Some of the things that all of this pretty well tells us where we're headed. But in a lot of respects, it's these Torah portions that we look at and we tend to say, oh, you know, I don't think there's anything I can glean from this. Sounds like stuff we've heard before. That if we really will stop and take a look at and ask those good questions, hey, where have I seen things like this in Torah? What is it that the Ruach, our Creator will guide me? And again, yeah, I've said it many times, the closer we get to the original language, the more we see some of these connections. The more we see, oh yeah, the Hebrew here. You know, sometimes in English they'll choose different words to translate it in one place than they do in another. But if you look at it in the Hebrew, you can't help but see the similarities. Yeah, particularly, I guess, for those of us that Hebrew is a second or a third language, it's tougher for us to read. And therefore, when we see these funny words, maybe they resonate a little bit more. And we go, oh, yeah, I recognize that. So if nothing else, think in terms of command Aaron and his sons. Don't tell them. Don't speak to them. Command them about certain things that are going to go up, the Olah, the Torah of this thing that is to be lifted up. I guess I'm going to suggest that what needs to be lifted up is us, that we can, in fact, be reborn. That was the goal. That was essentially the mission of these sons of Aaron, was to help this process, to guide the people of Israel through all of these things along the way as they went through first this time of trial in the wilderness and then later on into the land. Yeah, I like the phrase on the screen from Kevin. Parsha, each one of them. It's about a way back, right? What's the goal? Teshuvah, turn around. You're going the wrong way, and go back. And if we'll look, we'll find that he has given us lesson after lesson, many, many different ways to understand that we need to restore right relationship because it's been betrayed. And in so many places and in so many cases, the same things are still happening today. All kinds of fake gods. Almost any other god will do, other than the real one.